the dominance of Tesla over his rivals, which would be Detroit between Stellantis, General Motors, and Ford. They are also a big Chinese automaker, BYD, that is trying to compete. Has no chances so far. And plenty of others. So it looks like Elon Musk, I believe he's the richest person in the world, is getting up more and more. Dr. Roy.
Okay, I would assume most people don't want to have hear my opinion of Elon Musk. I don't think he's the richest one. He ebbs and flows. He goes up and he goes down. The value of Twitter/X is sinking every day. The share prices for Tesla are going down. His truck is apparently a disaster. And the semi is also a disaster. And most of his promises never take off like many of his rockets. So that article that you sent me is a puff piece. A lot of technical writers tend to be idiots. They listen to the PR people of the companies and they just recite what they said. If I owned any Tesla stock, I would sell it. I think it's going to go down, down, down. I don't think that the Roadster will ever happen, although there are loads of people who gave him $50,000 a piece just to be stand online. I think he did that 3 years ago, and there's no indication when he's going to bring out the Roadster. So he's Theranos done large. It's a grift. It's all a grift.
Thank you very much for that. I'm not asking others for your opinion because we have a short of time and I have to go over a few of them. There is a company, Pebble. Pebble is a motorhome, electric motorhome. So it's rather like a wagon that could be pulled by electric car, but it's totally made electric. And extremely luxury. Its price starts from $109,000 plus Pebble, if somebody wants to Google it. They have a website, but the website is beautiful. The only thing is that not much is to be found. More of this is fancy pictures. Of it, let me go. Okay, hydrogen passenger airplane. Imagine that you have ability to take any plane, any small, any big, or super big plane, and convert it to hydrogen. So, I sent Dr. Roy the email that says hydrogen passenger airplanes of regular airplane controversy. Because what it looks like, Lena Ahu Green had the problems with law. And I'm not sure, convicted of fraud. Tervor Milon, Tervor Milon, was convinced of fraud in October 2022, deceiving investors about company electric and hydrogen power 18-wheel trucks. Evidence suggested the company produced videos, whatever, so we know. We don't have to go to the specifics because I'm not sure what is legally allowed, even though that I'm quoting an article, but you don't have a link to it. All of a sudden, what is happening is that we have a year 2023. We have Zero Avia, certainly completed the first flight. We have 19 Caesar Dornier 228, which is the airplane converted to hydrogen. So the company says that, yes, okay, maybe they were not so successful with 18-wheelers, but they are successful with airplanes. Das 8-300, there is another one, and a few others. And then we have Universal Hydrogen. So the company name is Universal Hydrogen. Branded plane equipped with, of course, it's a different plane, but it's branded by Universal Hydrogen. Let me drop. Equipped with the largest hydrogen fuel cell ever to power an aircraft. So they got the FAA to approve the testing and the flight, and it looks like they're doing well. So the plane Dash 8S usually transports 50 passengers, but they have to remove some of the seats to make the place for the hydrogen tank. I'm not sure how safe it is to be next to the hydrogen tank for the passengers, but anyhow. Okay. In the test, they use 30 kilograms of fuel. 30 kilograms of fuel. 1 kilogram is 2 pounds. So 60 pounds of fuel. That's not much. And the fuel say operated through the flight, operating at 800 kilowatts. Well, we have a hydrogen fuel using spacecraft. I would love to have a comment of our space expert, N2XGN.
Royce, that wakes up, WD-28.
Well, I don't know what to tell you, Ed. Wesley isn't done yet.
All right.
Okay, so we have Paul. Do you have a comment?
Well, next year you're going to have four astronauts sitting on top of a SLS, Space Launch System, loaded with hydrogen and loaded with liquid oxygen as well. So they're talking about sitting next to a tank. You had 134 launches of the space shuttle, all liquid hydrogen. Liquid oxygen, of course, they have the solid boosters next to it. You have the Ariane 5 rocket, soon to be retired and replaced with the Ariane 6. Ariane 5, all liquid hydrogen. The H2 and the H3. There's an H2A and an H2B and an H3. Rocket that Japan launches. They used to launch to the International Space Station on a regular basis for cargo flights. Those rockets, all liquid hydrogen. So, what can I tell you? It's a popular fuel. Not the only fuel, but it's definitely a popular one. The second stage of a lot of these rockets, the second stage of the Delta IV, all of the almost 100 flights of the Atlas V, the second stage, they're running the A-10. That thing is liquid hydrogen as well. So there you go. A lot of future designs are going to have it as well. Back to you, Wes.
You know, hydrogen got a bad rap from what was 1937.
Thank you very much for your comments. Thank you very much for the other comments. We have a few minutes left. So I said I'm going to be short with time. The comment that the quote that I have, the FAA approved the first flight of Dash 8 ISS-300, the universal hydrogen plane, and it looks like to be hunky-dory. It's a promise. We don't know how good it is. The universal hydrogen modified DASH-H-300 is undergoing flight testing on Mojave Airspace Airport, battery electric vehicle made Nicholas disclosed. Posterior departure in filling with the U.S. securities and... Okay, never mind. It's not important. Let me go to another one. Okay, I have a few of them left. And Paul, we have... Okay. Elon Musk and other prominent players in space business see the future in Mars that would be a home for 1,000 humans. Actually, it's not to Paul, it's rather to Dr. Roy. So it's a startup creates IVF incubator to conceive babies in space. In other words, they think that in space that would be a problem for the people, for the human population to populate. So they try to test a self-sustaining human population on Mars in space or a space-simulated environment. Dr. Roy has the link to it, and the title on the email was Incubator to Conceive Babies in Space. Dr. Roy.
Really quick question, Roy?
Yeah, please. One second, Wes. Yes, Ed. You were alluding to the Hindenburg, I assume.
Oh, that's the Netherlands-based startup, Spaceborn.
All those flames, not the hydrogen. Hydrogen burns virtually transparently. That was a chemical screening on the skin of the gas bag. And less than half the people died. Was it a disaster? Absolutely. Was it as bad as everybody thinks? Not quite. But the damage was obviously the loss of life. The horrible flame has nothing to do with the hydrogen. All right. I've heard a little about this, but I think this deserves a nomination for the stupidest idea of the century.
Which one, the hydrogen or the womb?
The womb one. The idea of establishing a semi-permanent civilization of Mars to do reproductive research.
Okay, well, let me make sure I have the repeater. Okay, I assume I have the repeater. Yeah, I kind of agree with you. Wesley, this is some cluckhead that read The Brave New World. I read it when I was 12 and decided he could make some money off of it. There is no technology presently that can accomplish anything close to that. The umbilical cord, the fetal sac, the functioning of a human body to process all the biological material, the maternal kidneys that do the fluid and electrolytes, the mother's liver that does detoxification. It is an incredibly complicated, incredibly sophisticated technology that brought both you and I to be born. You can fertilize egg cells. You can grow them in a petri dish for a small amount of time when their nutritional requirements are minuscule. When they start to get complicated, you need to have a complicated system to maintain them, and no one has a clue how to do that yet. So these are a bunch of hucksters trying to make some R&D money on the side. It's you know, you might as well say that they're working on a transwarp propulsion system, because they probably have as much technological prowess in that as they do of creating an artificial womb.
Roy, I have to disagree. Very quick.
Okay, feel free.
If they were doing something productive and useful, it would be no less stupid than I did. It goes insane before it even gets to where you started.
Okay, I give you that, but motivation sometimes is an afterthought. Like I said, one of these guys must have read Brave New World back in junior high school, and he figured out a way to try to monetize it. And you know, the Mars is just an excuse. I mean, it's a stupid idea. It's a stupid premise. The whole thing is silly. And anyone who invests a dollar in this particular R&D company probably should spend their money on cryptocurrency instead. And I loathe cryptocurrency.
Let me tell you what K2RIW said on this subject years ago.
Okay.
Here is a thought experiment. To go to Mars and come back without even landing is going to take close to 2 years. Tally up. What do you need for 2 years in the way of food, water, air, waste removal, energy, and all that stuff? And you realize if you were going to stock up for 2 years, your supplies would probably fill the house you are living in now.
Yeah, I agreed with Dick then. I agree with Dick now. Unfortunately, a lot of this Mars talk is silliness. The idea that Elon, who I've voiced my opinion of him earlier, was going to get 100 people into a ship and have them set up a colony and survive is ludicrous. My best guess is that we will develop more and more sophisticated robotics, which will simulate astronauts to one degree or another. But for the foreseeable future, unless or until we develop some revolutionary breakthrough in propulsion that we can't even imagine yet, I don't see how you could accomplish this unless you want to kill some astronauts.
You mentioned
Roy, WS2N.
Are you familiar with the movie of about a year and a half ago, Don't Look Up? It addressed that, which surprised everybody, especially me.
Yeah, I've heard of it. It's on my list of many things that I have to watch. Paul, what did you want to say?
Ed probably remembers the name of the book, Packing for Mars. A woman wrote it, and Dick would highly recommend it, people reading that book. I have it, and it does give you all the breakdown of everything that you need. And it's a monumental task. Back to you, Roy.
Well, also, in addition to the supplies needed, physiologically, they're going to be in awful shape when they land. They're going to need servants to take care of them for a couple of months. And, you know, again, you're back to maybe robots, but otherwise, as it is when they come back from the ISS, it's not like they're ready to run a race immediately. They're basically carried in.
That's true. The only good thing is it's one-third the gravity, well, 0.38 on Mars, so, a little bit better, but, you know, it's the old story. Well, you have the people there help you when you land. You know, it's the catch-22 situation. Not going to happen for a while.
Yeah, I'm not alluding to Martian gravity. I'm alluding to that two-year trip that you're taking in space where, you know, the best that you could do is artificial gravity, acceleration or something, and that's not much.
Boy, let me finish my previous thought.
Certainly, Ed. Terribly sorry. Continue.
Don't look up. It's about some astronauts discovering an asteroid is heading for Earth. And their problem is not figuring out what to do about it. They're getting people to listen to them and believe them. But there is a recurring character who's kind of like a parody of a mix of Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and a few others. You know, you're a generic multi-billionaire. And at the end, the multi-billionaire and his friends take off in a rocket custom-built to civilize another planet. After the movie ends, there's a little postscript about what happens when they get to their new planet, and I'll just oversimplify it more. Dinosaurs.
Oh, okay. Well, at least for people who like dinosaurs before they eat you, that would be interesting. Matter of fact, if everyone out there who doesn't realize it, dinosaurs never actually died off. That turkey that you had the other day is a descendant of dinosaurs.
Oh, that's serious. As a doctor, you'll love this.
So let me continue. We have a few minutes left. I have a few subjects.
Well, you got it here. Send me 30 seconds.
Okay. Give Ed a minute or two, and then we'll go on to you. And I'm sorry I didn't realize that you were going to go through all 12 of those emails, but let Ed finish up for a second.
My sister-in-law is a doctor, and she doesn't live locally. Actually, she lives in Australia, long story. Anyway, my brother and sister-in-law in Manhattan, and we all went to the Museum of Natural History, and we're in the Hall of Dinosaurs, and she's looking at the dinosaurs intensely. And I said, "What happened?" And she said, "I'm counting vertebrae. 12 thoracic vertebrae, long forward, look at me, just like us." Maybe Darwin was right.
Yes, indeed. Maybe Darwin was right. Of course, it's not the political net. That's after 12. But the Speaker of the House would disagree with us.
He would disagree with us with anything we say. I don't think of a single word that was said on this net tonight he would agree with.
It's very possible. Thankfully, I don't have to have conversations with the gentleman. Seems like a very pleasant guy, but... I don't know. He has some inherent beliefs in the universe that I marvel at. Anyway, I thank you, Ed. I thank everyone that participated. And Wesley, if you want to wrap up, I'm sorry that I got you on late. I didn't realize this was going to take quite this long.
I have a few subjects very quick. Few words about Euclid Space Mission from Paul. They reviewed first full color images of cosmos. Paul.
Okay. Yeah, well, you're more interested in the science of what it's seeing. I was more interested in the launch of the thing by a Falcon rocket. It's been up there not that long. Only a couple of few months, and it's out with James Webb. It's out in that area. It's 1 million miles away. It's at the Lagrange point two. So I understand it's doing good. It's a European Space Agency telescope, and its main goal is to look for all these galaxies and compare them from time to time, and then they'll be able to figure out all about dark energy, maybe, or dark matter. That's the idea of that telescope. Well, we'll see. Anyway, back to you, Wesley. I saw the article that you sent me, but I know the results are just finally coming in. They just went through first light recently, so I guess this is the first scientific results. Back to you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Roy, the first ever successful whole eye transplant to the living person, Aaron James. It was done in New York, NYU Langham Health. The vision was not established, but I function normal. So all of the blood, all of the function, all of the movement is there. It's a half year later, and still no vision. But it looks like it was successful. Any comment, Dr. Roy?
Well, I put it on the link list actually last week, so it was there for anyone to read. It's fascinating. It's interesting. I'm not exactly sure what the value of putting another person's blind eye in your head accomplishes. It's also, I think, partially, they also transplanted a portion of his face. Unfortunately, he had lost it. So that makes a little bit more sense. But to just transplant an eye, a lot of people have lost an eye. And what they usually do is they get a glass eye. It's relatively inexpensive. You don't have to take anti-immune suppressor drugs that cause other problems. So the idea of transplanting a non-seeing eyeball, because it's relatively easier to suture together the arteries and the veins than it is to splice together nerve endings. They don't really splice. If you reposition the sheaths very, very well, you might get some of them to grow back into the other side and establish some kind of transmission. But I think it's, again, more of a glitzy thing that they did for PR points than for any practical use. Eventually, if anyone figures out how to splice successfully nerve endings, that'll revolutionize science and medicine.
Thank you very much for that. Discovery of the oldest ever black hole, Monday, November 6, 2023, at 1941. 470 million years after the Big Bang, it was formed. That was the black hole, and it was detected in X-rays using NASA telescopes. So my question to both of you, Paul and Dr. Roy, why is so young? Why so young? Not the way so old, why so young? Why the black hole didn't create itself or wasn't created earlier than that? So we have a 470 million years after the Big Bang. Paul.
I read that, and again, I don't get it. I don't know how old any of these black holes are. I know they're always looking for them, and there's countless black holes. So I really don't know why this one is so important, Wes. Back to you.
Dr. Roy?
Okay. Well, basically, the situation is that our understanding of post-Big Bang, we usually figure that things kind of work from small to large. And although there are black holes this big in our present universe, one is in the center of our galaxy, the belief tended to be that early on, 500 million years after the Big Bang, was not sufficient time for black holes to grow gravitationally to enormous sizes. But there are theories out there that there were mega black holes produced by some early forces in the formation of the universe. So this simply is a suggestion of further evaluation of what what properties, what aspects of a young universe could generate such a massive dark black hole. That's what it amounts to.
Thank you very much. And the last one. In 2050, we're going to be having a big problem with fresh drinking water. So Norwegian turning salt water into drinking water, preventing the crisis of 2050. Right now, the water is extremely expensive. You take a bottle, compare it to the price of gasoline, it's actually the same. So, you have a water. You just take the water, put it into the bottle, and charge like us if you were selling gasoline. That's in job. Sometimes you use nitrogen, N2, not LN2, N2, to put the bubbles in it. And it's absolutely amazingly tasty. I have it, Gerolstone, if I properly pronounce it, in Trader Joe. The best ever I tasted. So, Norwegian, they can produce 50 million liters, which would be 50,000 cubic meters of fresh water per day. And that is good enough for 300,000 to 400,000 people town. And they use the reverse osmosis. Dr. Roy, any comment?
Yeah, well, reverse osmosis has been used for many, many years. It's not inexpensive. It requires a very delicate membrane that gets easily damaged and needs to be replaced, which makes things expensive. It's an energy-requiring device. You have to apply pressure in order to reverse the osmotic diffusion that would normally occur. And so, like most desalination equipment, it is highly technological, relatively expensive, and a major pain in the backside to clean. If you're a big industrial nation and you really need it, you do it. Most countries couldn't afford it, and nothing's changed as of today. So reverse osmosis, very interesting, can be used, but it's not free. It's nothing close to free.
I see that this form of desalination of seawater was used since 1950, but the method that they say is quite inexpensive. That would be humongous help for, even now, for most of the African countries, also for many countries, even the United States of America, in areas where we don't have enough water, gas, how to get that sweet water, desalinated water from the ocean to some of the states. I don't know. Anyhow, thank you very much for time and attention. Thank you, Dr. Roy. Back to you.
Okay, very good, Wes. Thank you for your participation. It's not a cheap technology. If it was a cheap technology, everyone would be using it. People wouldn't be yelling and screaming about water shortages all over the world. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. I thank you all for your participation. It is now a little bit late, but I'm sorry, Paul, for the SpaceNet report.
ACTGS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Very good. Good topics tonight. Let me just start off with competition for Elon Musk. I'm not a big fan of his because he's very latent in a lot of the things that he he predicts. But I think most of them tend to do that. But, you know, he's way late, like 5-6 years late. They have the New Glenn that's being built by Jeff Bezos, which comes out of Blue Origin. And that thing is expected to launch late next year. And they have a different philosophy. I mean, it'll be a big rocket similar to what giant Elon Musk is trying to launch now, the Starship. The New Glenn is going to be a little shorter, but it's way up there. Elon's is almost 400 feet. This thing is 300, roughly 30 feet. You know, it's like a 33-story building compared to Elon Musk's 40-story building. But the diameter is big, too, 27 feet. So it's similar to Elon. Elon is 30 feet. It will be running the on liquid methane, similar to Starship. The difference is it's got different engines. It's got seven BE-4 engines, they're called, to get this thing off the ground, compared to Elon Musk has 33 of his engines. So there's going to be a big difference in thrust compared to one another. Now, Elon Musk thinks nothing of launching these things and blowing them up and then find out what's wrong and then take it from there over and over again. This company's not doing that. And NASA has faith in this rocket as well. On the first launch, coming up toward the end of next year, NASA's already signed with them to launch two spacecraft on that rocket, and it's going to go to Mars. It's going to go, two spacecraft are going to be orbiting Mars. And it's called the ESCAPADE, which is Escape and Plasma Accelerator Explorer. So we'll see how that works out. It's going to be a reusable vehicle. You take the Falcon 9, the first stage, yes, very reusable. The second stage is not. They waste that one every time they fly. This one's being built with the idea of having a reusable second stage. First missions will not have it because, you know, it's not developed yet. But they call it Project Javis. Project Javis is the is Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' idea of a reusable second stage. That's the name of the game in rocketry today, to drive the price down, having these vehicles reused. So I found that interesting. He's going to have two launch complexes. One, he's got launch complex 36 that NASA let him have years ago, and he developed the whole complete launch complex. It's already built. He plans on having another one in California in Vandenberg, so he'll be able to do polar launches as well. When they launch from Vandenberg, 90% of the time they're usually doing polar launches. So we'll see. How that goes. He's stepping up the game. When I say he, Jeff Bezos, with this Blue Origin, starting to pour more and more money into that rocket company. Any comments before I go on? Okay. Here's a topic that we talked about on the net before. It was a laser communication system that was being developed for the spacecraft Psyche. Launched not too long ago. I believe it was a couple months ago. They just launched this thing, and it launched on a Falcon 9 Heavy. So they did pay SpaceX to do it. It was back in October. So it's been on its way to, its goal is to go to an asteroid with the same name, Psyche. So it's been on its way. It's now around 10 million miles away from Earth. So that, you know, that was the first location where they were, NASA wanted to have the communications test. On board Psyche, they have a infrared laser, and the idea is to communicate with the ground station on Earth. Now they've done this, you know, from geosynchronous orbit. They've done it from lunar orbit, but you know, lunar orbit is only a quarter of a million miles away. This thing's already 10 million miles away. So they ran a test to do it. It's only got a 4-watt transmitter, by the way, laser transmitter on board. On Earth, they have a 5,000-watt transmitter. And the reason they have that is they transmit a signal from a location in California called the Table Mountain Facility at JPL. That's where they first transmit this couple of thousand watt signal to where they believe Psyche is. Now Psyche picks up that signal, they receive it, and they use it to adjust the transmitter. The transmitter transmits back, and it doesn't go back to Table Mountain. It goes to around 100 miles away to the Hale Telescope. The Hale Telescope is also in California, at Caltech. And sure enough, it worked. Once it locked in, it was able to start transmitting data back into the Hale. So it was actually a two-way communication. The idea of this whole thing is eventually if we go to Mars, they would like to have the capability of doing this as well. Say you're on Mars or in Mars orbit, you would like to be able to transmit a large amount of data, including video, back and forth to Earth. This system could be 10 to, they expect 10 to 100 times more data could be transmitted compared to using RF. So they're off to a good start. The system works. And of course, Psyche is still on its way. It's going to take, many months before it gets to, a couple of years before it actually gets to where they want to go, to orbit Psyche. I think they're going to run another test, and then at some point, they'll probably test it in that orbit. Now that's a big difference. That'll be like 100 million miles away from Earth when they test that. 10 million. So the dBs are going to drop off tremendously. You know, they have dBs with light as well as RF. So we'll see. If that works, then they know that once they are on Mars, if it works in the asteroid belt, it should work from Mars. No problem if the asteroid belt is further away. Is that a station with a comment or a question? Okay, now I hear you, Ed. Go ahead.
You were talking about using a laser as a data communications medium, and you said it's wider bandwidth than RF. I will agree because you can have a very wide data bandwidth, like on fiber cable, for example. But in a way, it's just like RF. But here's my question. An RF transmitter typically runs
Side of the spacecraft. You know, the primary goal of this, it's got like 10 instruments to do investigations of this metal asteroid. But as an extra, they put on this experiment, and it's going to transmit only 4 watts. And that's it. 4 watts of laser power back to Earth. That's it. The one on Mars is going to transmit. The one on Earth is transmitting up, I think they said around 5,000 watts. And, you know, naturally, by the time it gets to the spacecraft, it's got a wide footprint. And the spacecraft, once it picks up on it, it could use that as a guide, and they know exactly where to go. In fact, it's 100 miles difference. From where it's transmitting. Of course, there's good and bad. If it's a cloudy day, it's not going to work. But they would just wait for a non-cloudy day. They could also have one, you know, a receiver in Earth orbit in the future, where you could transmit back to that receiver tons of data. Like I said, at minimum, they 10 times the amount of RF, all the way up to a possible 100 times. That's what I've been reading for quite a while. I've been following this since its conception, a year or two ago. Back to you, Ed.
First of all, I've been listening to you and trying to go to the coming up with thoughts and questions, so I have nothing formulated on the head. One thought to the person. I have worked with industrial lasers that will put out a few watts of optical energy, a kilowatt out of the power. You say 4 watts. Is that 4 watts of optical energy? So how much power does it take out of the solar cells or whatever you're using to derive the electrical power? And if it is 4 watts coming out of the solar cells, how much
okay, you're breaking up a little bit. I got the idea. How much power is it pulling from the system? I know they have massive solar panels on this thing. You know, I think it's 85 square feet, they said. I think it could push, at that location, I could get almost 1,000 watts out of these solar panels. If it was around Earth, it would, you know, be like, you know, probably 10,000 watts, you know. But it's out at the asteroid belt. I think it's going to be 800 watts or something. Well, they're only going to use a small amount. The transmitter is 4 watts. How much power are they going to use? You know, even if it's, you know, similar to RF, it's going to be twice the amount. Maybe they'll use 8 or 10 watts. I'm not sure. And it's, you know, a function of time. This is a test. They'll be testing it, so I don't know how long they'll be transmitting for. You know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, 1 minute. I don't have that kind of information. Back to you, Ed.
You are assuming you can get, a 50% from DC power to radiated energy with lasers like you can with RF. My experience has been to question that. I think it takes a lot more power
out of the power mains, you give you 1 watt of optical energy based on my experience with lasers. On the other hand, you know, maybe they worked that one out. I'm just saying, it just raises an eyebrow, and I'm just bringing it up.
Paul?
Okay, yeah, I heard Paul. Yeah, I would. I definitely will be looking for that information. Yeah, interesting. Who said Paul?
Me, AC2GS.
Okay, okay. And that, I will definitely be looking for that information in the future. Go ahead.
Yeah, it sort of depends on what lasers they have decided to use, most likely for high power. Helium, cadmium, YAG lasers, the efficiencies are awful. Efficiencies of about 0.1 to 2%. If they have a diode laser, you can get as much as 20% efficiency. But usually those types of lasers don't emit significant number of watts. So it might be a very sophisticated diode laser in which it's 20% efficiency, but if it's one of the standard crystal types, then it's abysmal. That was the big problem with the fusion reactor, where they said that the amount of laser output was less than the amount of energy produced. They didn't factor in the enormous requirements to get the paltry amount of laser output.
Okay. Yeah. I'll definitely look into this. They run a test from the moon. They put one of these things on a spacecraft. Again, it hitchhiked on another spacecraft. The purpose of the spacecraft was not for the laser, but that was in addition to the spacecraft's normal operation. And I remember seeing the spacecraft didn't have these big solar panels. My guess is that it's maybe just doing it for a short period of time. You know, they transmitted video to and from this one going around the moon. And I didn't read about any power consumption for that one as well. We'll have to look for it. It's probably buried in a PDF file or something. Roy, back to you.
No, it's okay. I just wanted to add that because we've been talking about lasers for about a month now. You can get a nice bandwidth. It depends, again, on the type of laser technology. The narrowest range will give you about a gigahertz of bandwidth, and some of the broader-based laser technology can give you as much as a terahertz of bandwidth. So that's a lot of symbol rate going on.
Okay, good to know. So we'll have to look at that. But and I'm not kidding, these solar panels are just tremendous. And another one that has big solar panels is this one by the European Space Agency that's on its way to Jupiter. The name of this thing is called JUICE. And again, this thing just launched recently, and it just did a mid-course correction. This is a massive spacecraft, and the reason for it has a lot of fuel on board. It weighs almost 14,000 pounds, so it's like a 7-ton spacecraft heading to Jupiter. With fuel, it's got a... I'm not going to call it a wingspan, but a span of 90 feet for the solar panels. So 90 feet by 50 feet. So it's going to have a tremendous amount of electrical power. And the reason they need it is because they do have hail thrusters on board, ion thrusters. I believe they have three of them. And that's going to help them get to Jupiter. The goal of JUICE is to eventually go into orbit around Jupiter, and eventually in 2034, which is, you know, like 10, 11 years from now, it'll go into orbit around the moon of Ganymede. That's their ultimate goal. So for years it'll be orbiting Jupiter, and at some point it's going to use the gravitational assistance, find itself in orbit around Ganymede in 2034. So it's got a big honking antenna, over 8 foot diameter antenna, works on a K band and X band, and they expect to get 2 gigabits of data back per day. It's got a hard drive storage on board over 1 terabyte. So we'll see how Juice does. The reason I bring it up is they just did their first mid-course correction. You know, when they launch from Earth, sometimes the inclination isn't right when they, you know, it might be a little off to get to the ecliptic of the solar system. So they needed to make an adjustment. They knew this before launch. And they used up 10% of their fuel just to do that. Now, they're going to need a lot more fuel because when they get to Jupiter, they're going to need to use a lot of fuel to get into the Jupiter orbit. Okay, a quick question. Back to you, Ed.
Solar cells on Mars, as you said, are a fraction of the efficiency they are of Earth, but the sunlight is not going to do so. Now you're going to, they're going to Jupiter with solar cells. I was
that time
but
complete.
But they're better off from a radioisotope generator.
That's what they've been doing lately. We have a spacecraft in Jupiter orbit now. NASA put one up in 2013. That's called Juno, and that's got these 120-foot-long solar panels. There's three of them, and each one is probably about I would say 60 feet each or something. But it's these massive solar panels. There's three of them coming out of the spacecraft. Solar technology has gotten better, so they're able to do that all the way out in Jupiter. Unfortunately, it's getting harder to get the plutonium-238 that they need for the RTG, for the radioisotope thermal electric generators. They were really running low, and then about 10 years ago, because they weren't manufacturing anymore, and about 10 years ago, they decided, well, we ought to set up a manufacturing system. They've been working on it. Actually, we had to buy some plutonium-238 from Russia some years back. But then, and of course, that's not happening now. But they just got their first delivery, a couple of pounds of this stuff, and it took them roughly a year to make it. And so they have it's in short supply, so that's why all your missions that are going off that don't have it. Some still do. They saved some for Curiosity, one of the rovers on Mars, and Perseverance, they have it on Mars, as well as the New Horizon mission. That went off a few years ago. That has RTG on it as well. So that's part of the reason that there's just a shortage of this. So they have to do a workaround and pull solar cells. Back to you, Ed.
All right. It doesn't sound to me like a fundamental problem, just that nobody just wants to spend the money it would take to do it, because basically I think they stopped making this stuff, so you have to rebuild but dustin lines for a small amount, that would be very expensive. But if there's a steady need for it, that would probably justify ramping up a production line, because the World War II, they took a pretty high elevation from you.